Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Well, good day, night, morning, or middle of the night to you. It's the Nerdist Podcast number 294. Just leaving Nashville, which was an amazing bunch of shows. I really like Nashville. Then we went out and saw some honky-tonk. Late at night, everyone else was drunk. I was drunk on the fizzy parts of the club soda. But great, such great music. It's just so obvious to say that there's great music in Nashville, but there's fucking great music in Nashville. Now I'm heading to Chicago, where everyone will tell me that I'm a moron for not going to a different deep dish pizza place than the one that I end up going to, which I haven't figured out what it is yet. But I know, in the eyes of everyone I talk to, that'll be the wrong one, and I should have gone somewhere else. So I'm looking forward to that. But also doing the shows at Zany's on the 13th and 14th, Thursday and Friday of December in downtown Chicago, and then Zany's in Rosemont on the 15th. So I believe the website for that is it's chicago.zanies.com, and then maybe rosemont.zanies.com. But anyway, come to those shows. They'll be super fun. There's pictures and hugs and comedy jokes, and it's a good time. It is a very good time. I promise you they will be had by you, the good times. I'd like to thank Stamps.com for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. It's the holidays, and you're mailing a lot of crap, and this is really the time you don't want to go to the post office. It is, I think you would rather have a medical ass loosening than to go to the post office during the holiday season, because that's kind of what it feels like. They do not give you anesthetic at the post office, so rather than go through that, just get a Stamps.com account, print all your postage out. The mail carrier will pick it up from your place. Make sure and give him a nice Christmas present. Yeah, throw him a fiver or a tenner or whatever. Just something that says, hey, thanks for delivering the mail. Thank you. Because they do have to do that every day, rain or shine, except for holidays and Sundays. But Stamps.com will print out the exact postage you need. So use it. Go to Stamps.com right now before you do anything else. Click on the radio microphone at the top of the page. And then enter the promo code Nerdist for a bonus offer with a bunch of awesome stuff. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist. This episode is Judd Apatow, who I was very excited came on several months ago. We had a Twitter exchange where he said, my coming on your podcast is inevitable. I don't know if he meant that in a positive or negative way, but it doesn't matter because he came on. He has the new movie that is coming out December 21st is This Is 40, which was a fun movie and scary if you're close to that age. I'm not. I'm 29 forever. The fuck do I care? So, but other than that, Judd was a great guy. Not just sort of a very John Hughesian figure in our modern culture, but also a guy who is a huge comedy nerd. Huge comedy nerd. Like one of us kind of comedy nerd. So it was great to sit down and chat with him. Here we go. The Nerdist Podcast, episode number 294 with Judd Apatow. Apatow. Apatow for destruction. Oh, words. They're fun.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
No. Yes, yes, I mean yes. No, I know how to work this little podcasty corner of it. But the rest of this shit, I don't have any idea. All right. I've already started recording. All right. That's how it works.
I need headphones of some sort?
They don't work over there.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
This thing keeps
slowly
falling apart.
Do you want to leave?
In a rage.
I don't blame you.
Jump through that.
Leave and then punch Matt on your way out and be like, how could you get me into this? And then hit him.
How do I know how loud I am?
You're good. You're good. Although, the closer you are to the mic, the better.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good.
Is that how sound works?
I don't know. Jonah. Judd, it's really fantastic to have you on the podcast.
Has it started?
This is it, man.
This is it? Okay.
Yeah. And we're almost done. Thank you very much for being here.
I've got to get into podcast mode.
What is that?
I don't know. It's a very hyper alert mode.
Is it?
I just imagine a lot of young men listening to this in their beds.
Mm-hmm.
What are they doing?
I don't know. They're reading comic books.
And listening to words?
And listening to words. That's hard.
You got to give it up for those kids in their beds.
Sometimes being on a podcast, though, is a little like being in writer's room mode, where it's like, all right, I got to make sure all the cylinders are firing. I need to catch every bit and be able to add information at any turn.
You don't want to be the worst one. You have hundreds.
No. And let's be honest, the expectations for you are incredibly high.
I feel it. Believe me. I got a good night's rest for this.
There's a lot of pressure. I hope you had some protein this morning. Oh, Kyle brought smart waters. What's wrong with my dumb waters? Aren't enough for you, Kyle?
It's really dumb, the waters. Thank you.
I appreciate that. But there's so many things to talk about. I mean, I know you've done Marin's podcast, so you already talked a lot about your... But I really do want to talk about that you got to grow up in a comedy environment, which I'm so jealous of, because that is all I wanted when I was a kid, was to just be able to live in a comedy club, basically.
Well, that's all I wanted to do. I was a super comedy nerd. I only noticed it more and more by the day when I realized I think I out-nerd everybody. I used to watch Merv Griffin and Dinah Shore show every day, and back when Michael Keaton was a stand-up comic.
Oh yes,
you know, just the late '70s, and I just thought that seemed like the coolest world ever. There was still the remnants of, you know, Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. on all of those shows, but yet the beginning of like Leno and Jeff Altman and Seinfeld as the comics.
Yeah.
I just couldn't have been more into it. And then when I had the opportunity to be a dishwasher at a comedy club, I thought, all right, now I get to like see what's going on. And then I realized I was in the kitchen, and I couldn't see what was going on. And so I became a busboy at Eastside Comedy Club back when people were doing cocaine and it was like the height of stand-up. And it was a very exciting time to be 15 years old at a comedy club.
Robin Williams was doing 27-hour sets. Yeah, I think, did you ever read The Outliers, the Malcolm Gladwell book?
I have skimmed it.
Okay.
Who reads the whole thing?
Skimming
isn't
it's a
whole
big book,
thing.
Chris.
What?
I'll listen to him on a podcast.
Yeah.
Explain it to me.
Outliers is the very, that's my best Malcolm Gladwell. It was really just me.
That's all about putting in 10,000 hours to be good at something.
Well, not only 10,000 hours, but just sort of the... You know, when you sort of look at guys like, you know, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, any of the tech guys, they were exactly at the right age mm-hmm. when the environment accidentally happened to them, and they were the right people in the right environment. And so, you know, I feel like we all got very lucky to be at the right age for the comedy boom of the late 70s and all of the 80s to be able to feed that kind of voracious comedy appetite that we had.
Yeah. Well, I think it there was that moment, I guess, early 80s where it exploded and then it just oversaturated where there were so many stand-up comedy shows
yeah.
happening. And I did an enormous amount of those shows. And I was a terrible stand-up comedian. And I was on Evening at the Improv and Caroline's Comedy Hour.
Comic Strip Live.
I've looked at some of the tapes. I'm awful.
Really? You think so?
So if I got on... Everybody got on. The doors were wide open, but it was great to be in that moment. And as a young guy in that moment, what was exciting about it was when me and, you know, Adam Sandler, I was living with him at the time, and we would go to the Improv – it was still like Leno coming in at the height of like Leno as a stand-up and Seinfeld before the TV show when he was just the greatest stand-up ever.
Right.
Yeah. And then Robin Williams would come in and all these people would just rip the house down. And it felt very exciting in a way that now it feels a little more commercial maybe.
Sure.
I mean, back when the club was packed and the bar was packed and not only were people doing great stand-up, but there was like a whole... People were getting laid off of it. It was like a scene, you know? There was like a whole... Like Bruce Willis and Alec Baldwin were still at the bar, you know, hanging out.
So like the bar was actually just a place to... Just a bar, too. Like you would go and just hang out there.
The Improv was like a cool place to go.
Yeah.
Separate from the shows. And so I was a young guy. I took no part in any of what was actually happening there. I was just trying not to get kicked out. And I was just like the MC. But it was pretty incredible, the feeling of creativity there. But I don't know if that's just nostalgia. Like if people feel like the Comedy Cellar's like that now or something.
Well, it probably is. It probably is for them. It probably is. But I don't think that lessens what the experience was. I mean, my comedy scene really hit more in the 90s and like the Largo scene and you know, Death Ray and UCB. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, to me, I think of that as all the special time. I kind of missed out on the club heyday of comedy, but I've many times have I seen the 15th annual Young Comedian special, and most of those people have been on the show too. Kindler and actually Janine's never been on.
No.
Bellamy and Ray Romano.
And me, and I remember when we taped that in Arizona in 92, and that's 20 years ago. And just then thinking, Ray Romano is like the funniest guy ever. Who is he?
Yeah.
I just had heard his name around, you know, a New York comic. And then we watched him that night and thought, he's ready. Great things are about to happen for him. He was so much better than
he was a road guy though. Like he was a hardcore. He was a road warrior. But I always felt better about, about not really starting to hit anything until a little bit later into my 30s. Because Ray was like 34 when he did that.
Yeah.
And so that it wasn't like, you got to be 22. Like no great comic really, really hits it. Most of them until they're in their 40s. So that's always kind of comforting.
Truly great. People always told me it takes 7-8 years to find yourself.
Yes.
I was just kind of getting okay at 7-8 years when I stopped. And I remember when the whole Largo scene started at the Diamond Club, Dave Rath, what was one of the first alternative gigs in L.A. and Jack Black and Kyle Gass. I think that was like the earliest Tenacious D performances. Will Ferrell was doing an act with two other guys. I forgot what it was. There was just a lot of people just beginning to experiment on stage in a less pressurized situation and not just a crowd filled with drunk people, hitting on their dates the whole time.
Yeah.
But I had stopped right when it started, and I miss it. I kind of wish that I could have kept going, but I just got busy because we started doing the Ben Stiller sketch show and it just ate my whole life. So I had to give up performing.
Yeah. Oh, I knew Rob Cohen who worked on that show as well.
Dino Stamatopoulos.
Dino!
Was there. There's tons of great people came through there. And right when it ended was when I think a lot of the coffee house scene was taking off. I kind of didn't buy into it at first. I remember going with Colin Quinn to Big and Tall bookstore and they were doing stand up upstairs and I thought, who wants to do stand-up in a bookstore for like 18
hipsters? It was like survival. I liken that period of comedy. And now I wouldn't trade it, I wouldn't trade it for anything because I feel like the comedy boom, a lot of people were like, comedy's dead in the 90s, but I think it forced a lot of creativity and obviously people had to perform places. And I sort of liken that period to like if a vampire has to eat rats on a ship to survive, like that's sort of like it's just all of the survival bubbling up of people needing to do comedy wherever, in laundromats and bookstores and bars and how many great people came out of that scene. So it was good.
Well, I mean, I think the road scene and the Improv was really based on just pleasing Bud Friedman. And so you were trying to make them like you so you could work the Improv and work their road gigs. So when everyone started working at laundromats and bookstores, it wasn't about pleasing this one person. who could make your whole career by giving you stage time, which got all the TV shows to look at you. And then people could be really creative because you could bomb at this one place, and that place may not even exist next week. It was like that one person could control your entire career. We were all, I mean, it took me years to convince Bud Friedman to let me work at the the Improv. It was like a big deal if you got his blessing.
He's a tough monocle to crack.
It was.
Bud Friedman. Did you play an interview that you did with Seinfeld on Maron's show?
I played a couple of minutes of it.
People should listen to that.
I interviewed him when I was about 15 years old. I came out to visit my grandmother, and I used to call people and ask them to do interviews with me for my high school radio station, and I usually didn't even air them. I just wanted to meet people. I was like, how can I get like someone to talk to me and tell me how to do this? So I went out here, and he had this little apartment right below Sunset Boulevard, like around where the whiskey is. Mm-hmm. And I get there, and clearly I'm not a professional radio person. I presented myself as such on the phone and with his publicist, and then like a child shows up with a gigantic...
Is your dad coming anytime soon, buddy?
I mean, the tape recorder literally was from the AV squad. It could not have been larger. It
had the label on it for the school.
Big green... you know, thing from the early 70s. And I remember, you know, the look in his eye when he just realized, oh, I have to talk to this kid now. He's at my house. I wish I could tell him to leave.
You're an early podcaster. You were an early adopting podcaster.
It was early long form interview. And then his apartment was just like empty. I don't know if he had been there for years or moved in that day. There was no decorations on the wall. It was just he was there to write comedy. He was not there to do anything but be a comedian.
Don't you feel like he's a little bit of a comedy Dexter? Like a little bit of a there's like such method and everything's got a that I totally could see that.
It wasn't like he was about to really work hard to find the best couch for it.
I've purchased five of the same suits, so I don't have to expend any thought on changing clothes every day.
Jessica is like that. When I go over to his apartment, it's just like, it's like bare minimum, just like couch, bed, TV.
I have my version of that where I'll go to The Gap or J. Crew and buy like 11 polo shirts in every color, so I never have to think about it. And then he sat and talked to me for 40 minutes. And just basically taught me how to write a joke. I mean, he went through some material that he was working on and explained his process.
Oh shit! You've got to put that out. You must have.
What I liked it is when he was then the bit, which I remember. The bit was that he was saying. Right now I'm doing a bit about this guy who catches a bullet between his teeth, and I realize I don't remember this guy's name. And he's got to be thinking, what do I have to do to get you to remember my name? He goes, and how do you start this? Do you just have a friend throw a raisin at you? How do you build up to it? And he just walked through it, and he hadn't finished writing it. And he just couldn't have been nicer. And then a year later, I asked him if he would do it again. And he said yes and let me interview him for an hour at Caroline's in New York. So, you know, those moments with people who were very giving of their time... you never forget it for the rest of your life. He didn't have to talk to me and tell me anything. There was no upside for him. He was just a nice guy from Long Island. I was from Long Island. He gave me that gift.
And so what was it, at what point did you decide to transition, or did just the work transition for you, that you became writer, producer?
Well, I would do stand-up, and I was such a big comedy fan that I was able to observe myself and be disappointed. I understood where I was at. I could almost see the progression of what I would be. And I was a big fan of Seinfeld's and Bill Maher was somebody that I really, you know, looked up to. And I thought, you know, the best I'm going to be is like 62% as good as Bill Maher. And he's already great, and we don't need another person like that. And I didn't have any life experience. I didn't have some Stephen Wright approach to stand up that would reinvent the form.
Sure.
And I was annoyed with myself. I just didn't have a take on it other than, you know, some decent observations that looking back weren't even decent. So when writing opportunities started popping up, I would write, you know, the Grammys or you know, for Shandling, or I started writing Roseanne's Act. I just took it as a sign from the universe that you're supposed to be behind the scenes, because that's where all the work seems to be.
I didn't know you wrote for Roseanne.
Yeah, I wrote her act. I didn't write for the TV show.
I wrote for her stand-up act.
For a year, I would like go to her house on the weekends and sit at her breakfast table and write jokes for her.
So you finally got to unload all of those domestic goddess jokes you've been doing on stage.
And I knew nothing about being a woman and a parent. I was just guessing, and she would sit with me, and I remember she said, I want to do a bit about how it's better to suck dick than kiss ass.
Just go with that.
Because if you suck dick, you know, at least you know what you're going to get. But you kiss ass just based on the idea that someone might give you something. And then that's all she would say. And then I would have to go off and craft that into a monologue, which she did on her special. It was like a great routine that she did. And she was so funny, a billion times funnier than me. And she would give me these philosophies and areas. And then I would flesh it out and sit with her. And then she would make it legitimately funny. She'd
pull it into Roseanne speak. Yeah.
When you were were you still doing stand-up as you were writing for people?
In the beginning, I was. Because I realized something really early, which is all the good comics didn't want to sell jokes because they wanted to be famous so badly. Adam Sandler wasn't going to write you a joke for $50.
Right.
He knew where he was going, and so he wanted to focus on that. And I thought, this is the hole in the industry, this writing jokes for people. Everyone needs jokes. Everyone will pay you for jokes. If I could be that guy, I could pay my rent because I also had no money, and that turned out to be the case. It just there was a lot of people. As soon as people got caught wind of the fact that I could like help them with their acts or with some TV appearance, I got a ton of work out of it.
Did it get tough to start like your brain in the very beginning start to kind of split where? Like, you know, you were still trying to come up with your own bits for gigs, and then you'd be like, oh, well, this actually, I could probably get rid of this and give it to, you know, sell to this comic or...
Not too often, because I was writing for Roseanne, which was so specific, and Tom Arnold, and for Shanling, it was, you know, he was hosting award shows, so all the jokes would be about music.
Yeah.
And Gary didn't know that much about modern music at the time, so I would have to, you know, I'd write a joke almost to explain the premise of who was popular.
Right.
And then he would rewrite it.
I mean, you could just put it. It feels like, especially with Shanling, you could just sort of give him a few words, and then he would Shandlingize it.
Oh, he could just top anything. But if you basically gave him the premise of something, he would find a way to be much funnier.
Did you feel that these comics who were pretty much like, I mean, they were as big as you could get for comics? Was there any insight that you gained like, wow, they're way more insecure than I thought they would be, or, oh, look, they made it. Everything seems great. I mean, obviously, in Roseanne's case, everything going a little sideways, but...
Mainly, it just showed me that people work their ass off. It's such hard work. I don't think people have any sense of just how much work it is. It's like when I watch The Daily Show, I just think, how is Jon Stewart still standing? I've been doing that for so long. That show is so funny, and if you're anal about every joke and every nuance of every night, it must cave your brain in. Shanling was working so hard. Even on just writing the Grammys, it was such a monumental effort to make it really strong and stand out from another time somebody else did it.
Yeah.
And Roseanne, too. I mean, people work hard. They don't get in that position for any other reason.
The Stiller Show was... When I started at MTV in like 94, 95, I had stolen from one of the tape closets. Mm-hmm. We used to have tape closets, kids.
What's a closet?
Well, it's a place where tapes store.
Okay.
Hilarious tapes that you, they basically just had all of these, you know, comp reels for all these different shows. And so I took the one for the Ben Stiller Show, which was essentially an internal compilation of, you know, like a bunch of sketches. And, I watched the fuck out of that. I mean, it was, that show was so unlike anything else, and it bummed me out that it didn't last longer. But I guess I don't know what happened. Was it too referential for people? What was it? I don't know what it was.
We did that pilot, and you know, Peter Chernin was the head of Fox, and he was a big supporter of Ben. He really got what Ben was doing. Ben had done a show for MTV the year before.
Right.
That was a little bit like a precursor to the Larry Sanders Show, in the sense that he played a variety show host who was kind of a jerk to everyone who worked with him, and then they would cut to these sketches. And And Peter Chernin got kicked upstairs to a better job, and someone else was brought in to be the head of the television network. And we were told on day one, he doesn't get the show at all. He hates the Cape Munster sketch.
I don't know. Cape Munster! Yabba dabba doo, yabba dibi dabba doo ba dabba.
I said, if he doesn't get Cape Munsters, I don't know what to tell you, because that's all we got. I mean, that's the tone of this show. And so when we would get notes from the network, I would never take the notes, because in my head I thought, he doesn't even get Cape Munsters. I can't listen to someone who doesn't get the joke. These notes are not valid for me. But we were on at 7:30. We were so sure we were going to get canceled that Ben and I made a series of commercials where he was talking to one of the cast members of 90210, and he was just telling him that he shouldn't be a guest star in the Ben Stiller show because it clearly was going to get canceled and 60 Minutes was going to kick its ass and Mike Wallace was a monster who can't be killed. And so we were predicting our cancellation in the promos before that.
Self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah. So, and I don't know. It's hard to tell. Ben was, you know, one of the first people to look at those sketches from SCTV and what Albert Brooks did and said, what if we had money? Like, what if you could do a parody sketch and actually shoot it in the exact place where they shot the movie?
Right.
And he just took it to a whole nother level. Yeah. In addition to the style of people like Bob Odenkirk, who you know, was really dominant on that show with his style that kind of was the beginning of what he did on Mr. Show with David Cross, who was also there. So there was, you know, all of these things evolving, but they were all really new, and we were on at 7:30.
Right.
And then they moved us to 10:30 at night. So no one ever knew we existed. No one was famous on the show. No one knew who Ben was. So we didn't really have a way to get out there. And there was no internet, so it's funny to talk to people about it. Nowadays, you would just put a sketch on the internet and that would create the buzz for the show, like you
right,
would yeah. Key and Peele or something.
Yeah.
But back then there was no way to reach anybody.
You just send out mailers of half inch VHS tapes.
Back then the internet was like you know, it was still like weird, you know, lesbian chat rooms and you know, chat rooms of people who are into G.I. Joe's. It was this weird thing you didn't quite understand how to navigate AOL, it yet.
The AOL chat room. I did. My first experience ever in a chat room was finding a chat room on AOL in like 94 called TV Fun. I'm like, holy shit, I know fuck tons about television. We'll talk the shit out of television. I go on and it's, you know, and I'm like, hey, remember Larry Storch? And then people were like, I'm going to shove this pipe in your asshole. Yeah. And then it turned out the TV was a transvestite fun chat room, and I had no idea. Yeah. I was throwing out all this TV trivia, like throwing out lines and just getting nothing back.
That's why a lot of people were disappointed when TV Funhouse came out.
Yeah, because they thought that, Smigel, they just went the other way with it.
Yeah.
So that was their payback. But I mean, it's you know, for you, though, it's interesting because you keep making show after show that people love and they don't last very long, but they're still critically acclaimed and people are going, this is the best show on television. Why is this getting canceled? What's the internal struggle with that? Like, I feel like we're doing good work. What is happening?
I wasn't having that big a struggle about the work because I literally couldn't believe that I wasn't still a dishwasher. So even if a show went down, I would just think, I can't believe I have an apartment and I don't need a roommate. I can't believe I can afford valet parking.
Right.
So I just came from a place of being completely broke. So people, you know, I would be really mad and I would rage against the networks and I wasn't very political. I didn't know how to do the dance. But when we would think about what should we do next, I always thought, well, let's just do something else that we think is awesome. I never thought you need to mainstream yourself or find a way to succeed. It was always about what's the best idea, because I always felt ahead of the game that I wasn't still sitting in my room in high school watching the Merv Griffin show. Like, I'm in show business. I don't care. I got, maybe show business is getting canceled after half a season every year. And so I was still thrilled every second, even when I was having a nervous breakdown from being canceled.
Was it a weird adjustment to... I mean, I don't know if this sounds kind of lame, but was it a weird adjustment to then have a, like, money and like power and being able to do, like, is that a weird Or for you, is it just, nah, same thing, head down, do your work, don't worry about it, doesn't matter? Or did that take getting used to?
Well, in terms of money, I swear the only adjustment that I ever had was I was writing for Tom and Roseanne. I asked them to pay me $800 a week. So after a while of doing a good job, I said, you know, pay me $800 a week, and that's, you know, the cost of me for a year is how much is less than what you get paid for one show.
Right.
And they cursed me out on the phone. Oh, both of them on a speakerphone. Who the fuck do you think you are? You don't get paid that kind of money, goddamn motherfucker. And, like, they just went crazy on me. It was hysterical. And don't you think Roseanne? Yeah, what are you fucking asshole? It was, like, crazy on me. They're both on the line. But then they would call back like an hour later. Okay, we'll give you the money.
Jesus.
Like, we're coming down off the drugs now.
And then... And that was the change. It was to get $800 a week was the life change. And at the time, I was making $400 a week working for Comic Relief, producing benefits for the homeless.
All right.
So I'm making $1,200 a week. That is the only adjustment, because that led to valet parking. Because my car kept getting broken into constantly by the improv. I'm like, now I can valet. And then that was it. Nothing. I have no interests to spend money on. I only buy DVDs and books. So none of that aspect has ever mattered. In terms of having some control, that's a whole new thing. Whereas, you know, if you've always failed, people are up your ass because they think, well, you better help this guy because he always fails.
Right.
His shows never work. His movies never make money. As soon as you do anything that where it makes money and goes mainstream, everybody backs off because they think maybe he knows how to do it.
Oh, right.
And maybe we should listen because it worked last time. And at least I can tell people, you know, I listened to him because it worked last time. And that's been the great thing. Because then you could get really creative when everyone gets out of your way. Then you could seek out notes from the studios and the networks because they're trusting you, and then there's a better conversation. When you're a failure, no one wants to listen to your point of view about it.
Who was your... who did you sort of... Did you systematically go back and try to meet all the people that you were nerding out over when you were a kid?
Like, well, when I would meet people I interviewed as a kid, I never, ever told them I interviewed them. That I it took me years to tell Shandling, I kind of interviewed you when I was 16 years old on the phone. You're in Vegas. I Seinfeld found out because I let them use a photo of me and him in an article once in the New York Times. But no, I would never tell anybody. And I remember I was looking through some old photos, and I interviewed Alan Zweibel, the great comedy writer who was one of the original writers of Saturday Night Live. And when he left the room, I took pictures of all of his memorabilia in his apartment in New York. So I was going through an old roll of film, but it was literally like a stalker. All of his awards and photos with Chevy Chase and Gilda Radner.
You're just making all the stalkers out there feel justified. See, I could become a Judd Apatow type if I take pictures of everyone all the time.
So yeah, I didn't feel like it. I thought it would make people respect me less if they thought I was that kid.
No, but then when you're producing films and you have the ability to put people in stuff, you could call Steve Martin and be like, hey, Steve Martin, it's Judd. Do you want to be in a thing? Like, you have the ability to pretty much set up a meet. You can meet anyone now, and you don't have to apologize for it. So did you do that? Was there anyone that you hadn't talked to before?
That I made a point to just, that I must.
Like Steve, did you ever meet Steve?
We just shot a photograph for Vanity Fair the other day because I'm editing a comedy issue of Vanity Fair that's going to come out in December.
Very fancy.
So I shot a photograph with him, and that was one of the greatest moments of my entire life. And I had done a meeting with him maybe like 8 or 9 years ago, which was a big deal. There's no one really bigger for me than Steve Martin. And Albert Brooks is in This Is 40.
Oh, yeah. Yes. He's great now.
And so that was a big deal for me because I spent a lot of time as a kid. I remember I was in a library once. And this is how long ago it was. Nothing was easily available. So if you wanted to see the original article that Albert Brooks wrote, which was Albert Brooks' School for Famous Comedians, it was an article he wrote for Life magazine or Esquire or something. And I had to go to the library and get out the microfiche.
You have to get out microfiche, and then you have, or if you're listening to a recording, you have to be tethered to a desk with giant earphone cans.
Yeah. yeah, so it was a long road from that to watching all of his movies to thinking, I'm going to write a movie with a great part for him and then try to get him to do it. I'm very hesitant to ever think anything is good enough to bother my heroes with. So that was a big step for me to ask Albert to
It's scary too, because you want them to, I mean, and this isn't their problem, it's our problem as fans, but you want them to be the perfect image that you have, and there's almost and for me, it's, I'm a little scared to meet some people because I don't want to be like, oh, they're just a guy. Like, that's not fair of me to expect that of them, but I can't help that.
It's always better to be you want to be a friend, not a fan. You want them to kind of be like, hey, I know who you are too, or I've seen the thing you did, as opposed to you going, hey, where you're again? Okay, I got
to
go.
Yeah,
I want the work to be as good as what I think their best work is.
Right.
Like, so in order to bother anyone, I have to think I've written something that's like the quality level of what they've done. And I almost never think I've done that. That's why I don't attempt that too often.
People should listen to Comedy Minus One if they never have. Albert Brooks. Another kooky, crazy call.
On YouTube, I went down to Albert Brooks' hole and just watched all of his appearances. Like, just like the ventriloquism bit where he's just doing a really bad job.
Right.
And just like, just kept on going from one to the next.
I love watching him do Curly on The Tonight Show. Just watching Carson, like watching how hard Carson was laughing was just as entertaining to me as watching Albert Brooks.
I just interviewed him for that same Vanity Fair that comes out in December. And, you know, it was great to be able to ask him about all of those things. And but I also look at those movies. I mean, when you think of the influences that he's had, you know, that scene with where he's on the phone and he's high and he's depressed and he talks to Bruno Kirby in Modern Romance for, I think it's like 8 minutes without an edit. You could look at so much of what we've done and see how that style was an inspiration for so much of it.
Yeah. Well, and Albert, I mean, Defending Your Life for me was a movie that when I was in college, I could not get anyone to go see that movie with me because my friends were just college kids who didn't really care about comedy and they didn't understand why that movie was so important.
It was marketed. It wasn't really marketed like a Albert Brooks movie.
Well, it's also, I mean, like it also wasn't, I wouldn't really call Defending Your Life like teen humor, what I mean? Like it's definitely like there's like grown up issues and like being reflective on your life and dealing with fear and anxiety and all that stuff.
In the most high concept way.
Literally the most high concept way and fucking Rip Torn. Jesus Christ. We just saw This Is 40. When is that coming out?
It comes out December 21st.
Coming out December 21st.
That saw it on Friday.
Yeah, there were so many things because of my age that I was like, oh God, was it autobiographical in any way? Or was
I always say, it's a third based on our lives, a third based on our friends and Paul, and a third just made up to make it interesting.
Sure.
it's a soup. It's a little bit like a novel where, none of it actually happened, but it's all very emotionally accurate. It's everything I'm thinking about,
right?
And that we're debating, which is you get to a certain age and you think, how'd I get here? How do I feel about it? At some point you realize, oh, some of those things I thought I was going to do, I'm never going to do. This is my job. How did it go? This is my family. This is my wife. How are we getting along? And how can we make it better? And then, of course, whenever you try to make things better, everything just falls to shit. I mean, the effort to improve, as someone who loves self-improvement and self-help books, almost always leads to chaos.
Oh, you like the self-improvement book?
I've
read a shit ton.
I love them. I've read all of them, and I'll read them again. They're all highlighted and dog-eared.
Did you ever read Goals by Brian Tracy?
No.
That's a great one. But you have to listen to it because he has his voice is it's like an animaniac voice. I don't know how else to describe it. He's like, how far are you willing to go after you've done all that is expected of you? Like, it's the strangest. Just listening to his voice is the. It has its own meter.
So it's Eckhart Tolle.
It is.
Eckhart Tolle has interesting like books on tapes.
Yes,
because he has an accent and he's from so far off lands and he talks about being in the moment and every once in a while he just giggles at something he says.
If people could love me with this voice, you'll do fine.
Antidote for the poison you just drank, Dr. Jones. That's
has really... it helped you? Has it helped you, all of your self-help?
Yeah. I mean, I went through, like, you know, the big life transformation stuff like 8 or 9 years ago. And so, you know, I thought, well, I've spent so many years... because I think when you hit your early 30s, you don't think about anything when you're in your 20s. And then when you hit your 30s, you go, oh yeah, shit that I put into my brain actually does come back out.
Yes.
And it gets processed. And I'm not just like here to fuck shit up. You know, like you really have to.
What?
Well, Jonah just turned 30. So yeah. In a year.
Yeah, 30 was more my breakdown than 40. Because I always thought there was a lot of pressure to go nuts in your 20s. That your 20s were about, okay, this is the free decade to do things that you shouldn't do and experiment and travel and make awful mistakes with women. And so when my 20s ended, I thought, oh, that was it. That was...
What happened?
You can't do that in your 50s. I guess you could.
Yeah, sure, you could. But then you'd be like the people that you see on Real Sex on HBO, which is, are never the people you want to see fucking each other.
Yeah.
Creepy swingers clubs.
They're
always in a circle, like 12 couples all having sex, trying to have like simultaneous orgasms.
Simultaneous orgasms, or they're trying to telepathically orgasm. They're concentrating on each other's
but
junk.
Almost always overweight. That's the one constant.
No, I feel like there's some like super tan, skinny tree people, you know, like the hippie, you know.
That show's not edited in a way that you can masturbate to it.
No, not
always
in the least.
To an interview.
There's not, well, but even when it's not, and the camera's just, it's just like, oh, if you would just come a little higher over the shoulder.
I always try to come a little higher over the shoulder.
Oh, well, Jonah, well done, sir. Well done. I salute you. That joke was hotter than anything I've ever seen on Real Sex. I defy anyone to jerk off to Real Sex. It is impossible. It's like Mr. Show shitting on the flag bit. They have designed that show.
They can't do it.
It is impossible.
It's almost like the editor knows right when it would get good for you and cuts away at that point.
Almost too well.
So who was in the room when you watched it?
This is 40?
Yes.
Jonah was in the room and Carolla was in the room.
And our girlfriends.
Yeah, Chloe and Dee, Indiana. And
how did they respond?
They were, well, they loved it. I mean, they, you know, Chloe's a bit younger than I am. And so, you know, I didn't want to get all like, this is what happens, you know, but this will happen to you in a few years.
Like Dee and I, you know, like we just got engaged.
Congratulations.
Thanks. But like she's turning 30 next month. I just turned 30. And so it was a neat like, huh. Like this is, you know, it was neat seeing that just the settled and married life.
Well, it is. It's scary because I feel like every year older that I get, and it always happens around my birthday, I really understand talking heads once in a lifetime 10% more.
Yes,
I never understood it when I was a kid. I'm like, oh, that's really funny. And he's, you know, oh,
yeah,
you know, and all the hand motions and then the stop making sense concert. And then, but when you really listen to it, you go, oh yeah, you do. You do just kind of wake up one day and you have this sort of weird like, what? Like,
how did I get here?
It is like the kind of alternative reality movie where you're just in your body and there's your house and, you know, what does that mean?
But that's a great thing I think about movies is that there's a lot of movies I went back that I, you know, thought I really loved growing up and understood. And then I go back and watch them. I go, oh, that's why there was so much crying because there was emotions at stake.
It really,
you know, like you're watching the movie, you're like, why doesn't he just say get lost and be done with that woman?
It really did. The movie hit me in a weird place because, well, I mean, like Melissa McCarthy is so, I mean, fucking, it just hurts me how fucking funny she is. So it was, you know, obviously there was certainly great riffs in the movie but parts of the movie really made me sad. Like in a, oh yeah, someday, you know, sometime you might just have to go, yeah, this is it, you know, this is it. And we just have such a hunger to always be like, it's never over. We're always, you know, and then every once in a while you kind of go, this is it, you know? Yeah. Like
this
I just
is the life
to,
I've chosen. I have to make the most of it. And that's, you know, those are the issues that I'm always fascinated by, whether it was this or Funny People. And in a lot of ways, it's in even 40-year-old version of just, you know, tracking time and where am I supposed to be and what was I supposed to have accomplished and the panic that creates, which I always think leads to a lot of good comedies, the panic to make some sort of adjustment is what leaves you lead you to want to, you know, to have sex with the drunk woman who crashes the car on the way home.
I wonder how many more. I wonder how many of those panics you. Like every, is it every decade you get a panic, or is it every 5 years, or does it as you get older, is it like 10, 20, you know?
I think you naturally start letting go and relaxing a little bit. I think it's almost in our DNA. You know, people I know who are much older seem to naturally be mellowing out and enjoying being older.
Sure, because their brains are filling with estrogen, because the chemical levels are switching, because they're getting older, and their brain is actually... is injecting them with chill the fuck out juice.
Yes. How do I get that now?
Well, you have to eat someone's brain. You have to crack an elderly person's skull over and suck their tender juices out of their lobes.
There's an argument to do that. Some days Listen, I do want to do that.
Everyone, you'd be doing them a favor, really. Yes. Do you want to be 88, 92 years old? See, if someone could benefit from my chill out brain juices when I'm that old, fucking suck it up. I'm fine with that.
Well, I always think, when I'm trying to think of a movie... I always do try to come up with something that I think I haven't seen much of.
Yeah.
And there are certain types of comedies that, they don't make much anymore. Just about the people and problems, and you don't need a villain and you don't need a high concept. It's just life is filled with enough obstacles as it is.
Yeah.
Any day can give you enough comedy. And but when we make them, I'm usually not aware that it's such a strong choice. And then a year or two later, I'm like, wow, I did that. What was I thinking? I was really, like a year or two after finding people, I'm like, wow, I was really depressed then, I guess. I really was in a weird space. I had something to say there.
That is the most interesting thing to me about doing stand-up or writing or whatever it is, any kind of artistic endeavor. We just had a long conversation about this when the Wachowskis were on, of just talking about how you sort of just like, you just kind of throw all this stuff onto whatever your canvas is, and then you go, oh, I guess that's what I think. Like, you really just don't know the art part of it is sort of processing all that shit.
Well, you know, a lot of people say, I write to figure out why I'm writing it.
Yeah.
You know, you make a movie to figure out what you're thinking about, and each movie becomes a little time capsule of the issues you're dealing with at that moment of your life.
Yeah.
And so you don't even know what the next stage, will be. That's why I never think about, adapting a book or whatever, because I'm actually just much more interested in thinking about my own struggle.
Well, that's a stand-up's point. Like, your films are basically, to me, they seem like stand-up driven, because they're point of view driven, and you're relating these experiences in a very kind of with the same mechanism that you would have if you were a comic, the way you're just sort of telling a story.
Yeah, and I think that you have all these things that you're going through, and then you think, how do I make it crazy funny so people will listen to these ideas, but it's actually still entertainment?
Right.
Yeah. So I usually don't start with a comedic idea. I start with a dramatic idea, and then I think, well, what's funny about this? Oh, I guess it's funny to, I want to talk about how romance fades. What's the worst example of that? I guess it's having your wife walk in while you're taking a dump, but you're really just on your iPad escaping your life. Or asking your wife to look at your anus to see if it's a tear or a hemorrhoid or a worm. That would get across what happens.
Yeah.
And then it also buys you time in the movie to talk about things that are more serious, because at certain intervals you're going to try to really tear down the house, and you're trying to get the rhythm right between the drama and the
comedy. You have to have some humanity to kind of tether it to for people to relate to. Otherwise, it's sort of, then the comedy you're making is like a Zucker Brothers movie, and that's just an entirely different approach, which is...
Well, I love those movies. I mean, when we did Walk Hard, it made me really appreciate those movies like Airplane and Blazing Saddles, all the ones that I thought were the funniest movies ever made. I mean, a challenge like no other. Like, can I make a silly movie where every joke is the funniest joke ever and I rip the house down for 88 minutes? It is a completely different kind of movie than the dramedy movie. Because when we did Walk Hard, we would test it and test it, and we were like, anytime a joke doesn't work, the next 10 minutes bombs. So we had to go in and do like reshoots to go, oh no, every joke has to work the entire movie.
Oh, or fuck.
It's exhausting. It completely caves in.
Yeah.
So what they do is incredible. And it is fun every once in a while, to try to do like just the joke-a-thon. I was one of the writers on, Mess with the Zohan.
Mm-hmm.
Just to be around Smigel, Robert Smigel, like someone who is like funny at the highest level you've ever seen. I mean, he's the guy who does Triumph the Insult.
Yes, yeah. And TV Funhouse.
And he's in your movie.
And he plays Bull Rudd's best friend. I mean, that's something of being around those people who are that good, who can really kill at any moment.
What was the brand name he had on his biking gear?
Oh, it was like something Bastard Ale or
something.
Yeah, it
was an Arrogant Bastard Ale. It was just like the heaviest beer.
I'm surrounded by those bikers.
Yeah.
Whenever you're driving anywhere, there's so many bicyclists out, and they're really mad at you that you're on the road.
Yeah.
And sometimes you see them and they're in such blind corners where no bicyclist should be. And they don't care. They're like halfway in the street, and I fear for them. And
not is, anybody, they need the bells more than anybody.
But it's bikers. It's a symbiotic relationship of hatred, because my ex-girlfriend's a cyclist and she rides everywhere, and she's almost gotten hit so many times that it just develops this like, everyone's unhappy.
Yeah, I was once bumped out of a bike lane, like by a car, and like the lady saw me, and then I remember just angrily slamming my hand down on her hood and leaving a dent, and then getting really scared and just biking away.
I don't like any activity where I'm just exposed to be hit.
Yeah.
So when I rode a motorcycle for a very short period when I was in college, and I just thought every time I stopped for a light, I thought the guy behind me may not see me.
And this could be it.
And I'm dead.
Yeah.
And I don't get the people that are very comfortable being exposed around big cars.
Or how about people just like whipping in and out of traffic where you're just like, and you know, it really doesn't take much to just flip your bike on top of yourself. And then they're just scraping gravel out of your flesh.
I've avoided that. That was one that my dad always talked about when I was a kid. He had the friend that lost his leg.
Right.
My dad was, in terms of scaring me, was a lot of the inspiration for Joe Flaherty and Freaks and Geeks. I had a friend who rode a motorcycle. You know what happened to him? He's got a leg. I do that with my kids. I've scared my kids so much about the drugs and everything, because I just, you like this song? That guy's dead. And I just do it all the time. I'm not joking.
Well, that generation, because I was definitely, my mother was very overprotective and okay, just make sure you're home by a certain hour. Everything will kill you. Yeah. And I guess it's just a product of when they grew up. I mean, like, you don't have to go back too many generations to the world being a sharp, dangerous, poisonous kill planet.
Yeah, my grandfather, he had one eye because of a moped accident. And so when I brought up the idea of I want like a moped or a scooter, and everyone was like, no, don't even say that. Don't even bring it up around him.
All those in favor say, what happened? Are you good with it? Because obviously you work with a lot of teams, but you've really, I think you've done the thing that a lot of people I would hope would want to do as they achieve success, which is like, hey, I have a group of my friends and we all want to work together and we like working together and we like helping each other. And I don't know. I think one of the things that people are drawn to, just besides the stuff you make, is just that it feels like, hey, we're a community of people that are supporting each other.
Yeah, that's what makes it fun for me, because I do come at it from the point of view of a fan. So when I meet somebody that seems really talented, I just want to be around them. It doesn't matter if they're like a child. I just think, oh my God, that Seth Rogen guy is the funniest guy ever.
Yeah.
I'd love to do a bunch of things with him. And then you meet more people, and then the group gets bigger and bigger. And every time you start a project, you think, which of these people fit into this idea? You can't force them in if it doesn't work. But with the new movie, I thought, oh, I could put Charlene Yee in this movie, and she's so funny. It'd be great to do something that shows people how hilarious she is. And I just worked with Melissa McCarthy and Chris O'Dowd, and I was thrilled to get Jason Segel in. So, but then there's like a limit, like, okay, that's all this can hold,
right?
This project. And you feel bad, like, oh, I wish I could have had Jonah in this. I wish I could have.
Thank you. I thought the same thing about myself.
No, it's not.
Oh, Jonah Hill?
I know. Yeah. Some people have the same names as other people.
But I mean, that's my favorite part, is when everyone is having fun together. As a kid who like grew up like in a divorced house, like the idea of like creating these families has always been the part that's attracted me the most.
Oh, that's nice. I like that. I'm trying to do that with these jerks.
Yeah.
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 Well, if you call us jerks all the time like that, it really.
Well, that's a
family. Okay, you're out. You're out of the family. You're fucking out of the family now. No Thanksgiving, no movie.
But that is a fun part about watching even just the extertiary movies that you just are a producer on, like Sarah Marshall, which I think is a great breakup movie. Seeing kind of your influence around, and then those people like probably from like the people they met on your productions, bringing them into their productions, and then yeah, just kind of that spider web.
And it also spins
it's kind
from,
of a pyramid
like,
scheme.
Yeah, and it spins a little bit like from like Stiller's movies or Adam McKay's movies, and everyone kind of notices. Oh, he used that person. That person's fun. Let's give them a bigger part in this one.
Yeah,
I remember I met Jack McBrayer on Talladega Nights, and I think it was right before 30 Rock, and it was someone that Adam knew, and we all thought that guy's the funniest guy I've ever seen. Yeah. And then so, you know, we would say, it's a Stoller. Oh, you got to use Jack and Forgetting Sarah Marshall. And then it just spins around like that. Yeah.
Have you ever seen Jack do improv? Have you ever seen any of the I.O. shows?
No. Two-man improv?
No.
Fucking A.
It's really, it's great.
He is, seeing some of those guys work together, you know, just him and the Scott Adsits of the world, yeah. And just like mm-hmm. watching those guys improvise together. You're like, oh, this is what improv is supposed to yes. be. It's not just being like, hey, I'll have a snappy comeback for anything. It's like they're actually creating amazing improv together.
Yeah. Jack and Paul Scheer have like a really good two-man team. It's really good.
Well, it's a great time, I think, in comedy now. I do think things are evolving where there's just places for people to learn how to do it, both in the coffee houses and comedy clubs and improv places. And there's been a lot of good movies made, which is leading to more movies and more opportunities. It really does feel like a golden era mm-hmm. right now for comedy.
Are you doing any digital? Are you doing any like any web stuff? Are there any projects that aren't maybe a whole movie, but like, oh, this will be fun to fuck around with?
Well, you know, I'm one of the partners on Funny or Die.
I've heard of it.
I haven't fully created things just for that platform. I'm just beginning to learn about the whole world of the 12-minute television shows and how they do it on an Adult Swim. And so hopefully we'll think of something for that, but I haven't gone for it yet. But I like the idea of low pressure. You know, I hadn't done TV in a long time, so when I met Lena Dunham, I thought, well, it's worth doing this show because she is such an amazingly talented, nice person.
Yeah.
And that has woken me up to the possibilities of ongoing characters and also things that are just weird. Like a movie needs to have a resolution. You have to kind of feel okay at the end for the kinds of movies we make. But I love that an episode of Girls could just end really down.
Yeah.
And that's what, when I was at the Larry Sanders Show, I mean, Gary could do that. You could end on these really weird notes. And it's definitely reminded me that you can't do some of these things in movies and that you have to go to television or to digital to get some colors.
Well, I mean, you know, the digital stuff is, there's much more of a sketch element mm-hmm. to it where it's sort of a single idea that you're getting across in a compact parcel of time. But the thing that I've learned the most just doing it for a while is that people look at it and they go, oh, well, it's like television or movies because it's a visual medium. And you're like, no, because the thing that makes the ecosystem work is that people have to share the thing that they're seeing in order for it to become anything.
Yeah.
And so if there's not an element in there of something special that makes people go, holy fuck, I have to pass this around right now, then 100 views, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just, I think it's a different of enough of a philosophical approach. And I think that's why a lot of people don't do well at it. They're like, oh, we'll just put TV on the internet. Like, well, it's sort of.
Yeah, it is tricky. We notice that just when we make funny things just to promote our movies, like, wow, no one passed that around.
Yeah.
And then suddenly something will explode. You know, oh, like the Bridesmaids bloopers for some reason have exploded in a way we never thought possible. And something we would work so hard on just no one would watch.
Yeah, it's usually the way it works. If someone says, make a viral video, it's like someone going, well, write a hit song.
Yeah.
How was Bridesmaid a tough movie to get across the finish line, or was it?
Well, the studio always wanted to make Bridesmaids. It was really more about me and Kristen and Annie Mumolo thinking it was ready, that the script was ready. They always thought it was a commercial idea at the studio, but they worked on that script for 4 or 5 years before we made it, but it wasn't because we probably could have gotten it made with an earlier draft. It just felt like this is a great idea. We have to do this correctly. And Kristen only had summers to work on it because she was so busy at SNL.
Sure.
She couldn't accomplish too much during the year. So that expanded how long it took to make. But it was hard. It was really hard work. That wasn't, an effortless banging out of a draft because in a way, Kristen Wiig was creating her film persona. So you have this person who's really hysterical playing these insane characters, and then you're thinking, how can I make her equally as funny where she doesn't get to do any of that?
Yeah, you know? I don't think most people have much of a sense of who she is as a person.
Yes.
Because she just fucking disappears. She's one of those sketch performers where no matter, then Will Ferrell had this too, where no matter where they are in a scene, you just, your head follows them because they're just, so they're in it.
Yeah. And that's the hard thing. If you look at the history of Saturday Night Live or any of the sketch shows, very few people have figured out who they are to be a movie star.
Right.
And so, you know, there are people who came off the show like Bill Murray or Sandler that understood, you know, what their persona was enough to make a transition. But there were so many people who were insanely funny, but you never got to know them as people.
Dana, Dana didn't really play just a guy very often.
I think people have, there are so many different skill sets, and you're developing a different skill set on a sketch show. So like with Kristen, you're starting from scratch. Like, okay, I'm not doing anything that makes me the woman with the tiny hands or the target lady. I'm not doing any of that. So now, what is funny about me? How would I get a giant laugh?
Right.
In a movie like this, where it's heartfelt and sincere, but we do want it to be funny because people know that she's one of the funniest people who ever lived. So it cannot be funny.
That's why I think it's always best to play the friend. The friend yes. roles, one dimensional, you come in, you get to be out, you know, like you get to fuck around more, and there's no pressure on your shoulders to carry anything.
Yeah. It's like being the middle act.
You're a bonus.
You're a middle act.
You're kind of a middle act. You're a bonus, and it says low stakes, you come in, like.
Well, that was part of the challenge of This Is 40, is that my wife, Leslie Mann, and Paul Rudd, they were the friends in Knocked Up, so they could come in and just kill, you know, in half a dozen scenes. And then when you say, okay, now I'm going to make a movie just about them, then you're saying, okay, so now I have to go much deeper. I want to be as funny as last time, but all the rules have changed to do a feature that's about them at the center.
Do you have an opinion in this movie on who you think is right or wrong, or do you just sort of put it out there and then just go, well, these are these people's lives. You decide. Do you have an internal thing of like, well, it's really more his fault?
Well, when we make the movies, you know, how they get written is I'll have, you know, an idea. So I'll say to Leslie, you know, I was thinking maybe we could do something about what's going on now. and then I'll say maybe it all like leads to a birthday party. Like they both turn 40 during the same week and they kind of have a little kind of meltdown in that time period. Maybe that would be fun to watch. In the beginning, I used to say it was like the movie Falling Down with a couple. and so I would talk to Leslie about, like, she wouldn't be reading pages, but I would talk to her about scenes, and then she would say, you know what you should do is a scene where, and then she would pitch me the scene where Pete does something awful.
Yeah.
And so slowly it would be my point of view and Leslie's point of view, and she would just balance it out if she ever thought, you know, there was a lot of moments when we were making the movie where she's like, Rudd is playing it like way too much of a nice guy. He's got to be a little bit more of a dick or this movie doesn't work. That's why there's literally a scene where she says, why are you such a dick? He goes, I am a dick.
I love that scene. Everyone thinks I'm a nice guy when I'm not.
Because you want it to represent equally both of their point of views and to show that they both have problems. They both have wounds, and how they behave with each other is based on how they were treated by their parents.
Well, yeah, I mean, to me, Rudd's character is still a man-child who doesn't want to grow up despite having a 13 and an 8-year-old daughter, and Leslie's buckling from the pressure of trying to keep a family together, and it's just like, and then they both have the crisis at the same time.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think there's a lot of couples like that where women feel like they're just trying to make everything work, and their husbands are busy and spaced out, and they just want to shut down, and they want, and women want a partner in it, and guys literally just want to go in the bathroom and play Words with Friends and get a break.
Right.
And there's a real clash there of men just thinking, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. And a woman going, no, it won't be fine if we don't do A, B, and C. And then you get, it's very much a clash of personality styles. You know, some people really think they can make things better by just like making a list and saying, well, this is how we'll raise the kids, and this is how we'll deal with vaccinations, and this is how we'll deal with this. And if you disagree on that list or how to approach it, you could be at war over everything all day long.
Right. Well, especially when so much of your lives, I mean, you know, I don't have any kids, but I can't imagine the pressure that sort of, because then you're really responsible for other people living.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And you think about it all day long.
And you cannot be selfish in that case. And I'm sure I would imagine that as you start to get older, parts of you are like, I want to be fucking selfish. I just want to be selfish for a minute. Like I used to be able to be selfish.
Well, you don't want to be worried about somebody else all the time. That is why a man is in the bathroom. Because you do care, but you want a break in a different way. And you, for instance, in the movie, they fight about Western versus Eastern medicine. And that seems like, oh, maybe it's not the biggest thing in the world. But if, as a person, you think, I believe in Western medicine, give me the antibiotics, give me whatever kills the bad thing in your body, then that's, you know, that's a strong position. But if your wife thinks, no, I believe in herbs, and I know that there's no studies that prove they work, but I have a female instinct that will heal our children, and it shouldn't be about killing disease. It should be about supporting the body so the body can prevent disease. I mean, you could fight about that for 1,000 hours. And so, in a relationship, you've got 200 of those that you have to have your position, and then you have to decide, which ones am I going to give in on?
Right.
Is this the one to give in on? If I, you know, we've had that, like if our kid has an earache and I want to give antibiotics and she wants to go off dairy, someone's got to give in. We ain't doing both.
But in that instance, it sounds like you're saying that the Eastern medicine is a little less sensible than the antibiotics.
Well, I kind of do. Like, I'll get acupuncture stuff, but I lean Western. And the reason why I lean Western is like, if I ever get like a terrible disease, I don't want to have a headspace like, I don't believe in medicine.
Right.
I want to go like, I've convinced myself my whole life it'll work, so I could be happy believing the doctor's point of view will work.
Right.
If I go Eastern now, when they like tell me I have something horrible, I mean, then I'd be like, that would melt me down. I want to believe that they know what they're doing. Yeah. I don't want to think like all Western medicine is bad and we should only like have a tablet of this plant. But the truth is the plant might work better. I'm not saying it won't. You know, that's why you get kind of caught in the middle.
But it probably won't.
But who knows? Who knows? And are you getting the plant that you think that you're getting? Because they could say, like, here's this beautiful valerian root. But really, it could just be like some Chinese guy just ripping down any piece of crap plant and chucking it in a
jar. Oil
of
the snake.
Yeah. Exactly. You don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm somewhat skeptical of all of it, like all of it, because I feel like, you know, big pharmaceutical companies have so much to gain. And so, you know, of course, they want to keep you on medicine because it's a, you know, multi-billion-dollar-a-year industry. But then Eastern medicine is like, well, there's not really any regulatory committee. It's like, well, here you go. All right. It's a lot of trust.
And their offices aren't nearly as nice.
Offices, they're usually like apartments and they sleep behind the dividing shade with the Chinese characters on it.
Oh, we've done all of that. We've done cranial massages.
Yes.
Sacrocranial massage that, you know, where people just like give you the softest massage on the membranes of your skull to make you better.
Yep. Hmm. There's a museum somewhere in the country called the Museum of Questionable Medical Devices.
Yeah.
And it's just all of the like the quackery from the early 20th century of like, oh, the electrodes and then these crazy things. And then, you know, all the massage, like you said, the massage devices.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of what marriage is about, is that, as you'll find out. Because it is a giant negotiation over all of these things. Do we want our kid to go to a school that's really like hard on them scholastically? Or do we want like a trippy hippie school that's really loose and non-competitive? and you're like, I can't believe I have to like agree with somebody
on
all of these things. Why can't I just win everything?
Pretty much anything you do is going to fuck a kid up in some way. Yeah. They're going to find a way to get fucked up by it.
And here's the weirdest part when you're a parent. The part of them that's fucked up may take them down, but it also might be their motivator
for
everything they accomplish in their life.
Sure.
So much of what we accomplish is a result of pain.
Of course. You even said it. You said you grew up in a home, like you moved around a lot, and you kind of, like there was sort of a broken home element, so now you've created this family.
Yeah.
And maybe that wouldn't have happened if, you know, if you had the perfect family when you were growing up.
Maybe I would have become a drug addict.
Maybe you would have become a drug addict.
I mean, so you can't even say that a perfectly happy childhood will work. I remember Loudon Wainwright. I was talking to Loudon Wainwright about schools, and oh, this school's supposed to be good for the arts, and he just said, "Whatever happened to art coming from pain?" And that, you know, that is that's the funny part about it. And also, I've seen a lot of kids who have a really bad period in their lives where they just have all sorts of problems, and then they pull out and kick ass.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you might think in that moment, like, "Oh, that kid's doomed," but maybe that's the kind of great defining turn in their life. It's like Russell Brand in a way. You're like, when you ask Russell Brand, like, why did you stop doing drugs? And he said, because my career wasn't going well enough. And so anything can motivate anything at any moment.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was one of the reasons why I gave up the booze almost 10 years ago. I was like, oh, I'm not really working that much and I'm fat. And then after you quit for a while, in retrospect, you're like, oh, there were a million other problems I wasn't even aware of. Like, I wrote a kind of a self-help book for nerdy brain people. And one of the things that and the lesson that I drew from that was like, if you need to start with your own vanity to try to pull out of something, then absolutely do it. Like, because you will gravitate toward that because, you know, so many of us have such unstoppable egos that if that's the thing that makes you stop and reflect, then fucking great.
It's the only thing that makes me consider not drinking. Every time I just look at my belly, I'm like, ugh. Really got to cut back the booze, not for any other thing.
The one thing I slowly realize is that in my relationship with Leslie, that I'm wrong on almost everything. And it takes you to really let your ego disappear for a moment to realize how many things you're fighting for that you're completely wrong about.
Yeah,
it's shocking how long that list is and how many years you will fight on an issue. And then one day you just kind of very quietly just think, oh, can I tell her she's right, or I'll just slowly drop it?
We are biologically designed to fight, to protect our points of view, regardless of what the truth is.
I read that was a big study about politics.
Yes,
it's really hard to get people to change their view, regardless of evidence.
Politics or religion or any core belief that people have, no matter, like, you could say, like, you could have a tape of someone like ascending from the clouds being like, hi, I'm Christ. I came back again like 3 times and no one gave a shit. Here's proof of that as exhibit A. And people would be like, no, because Christ would come in on an angle. Like, they would find a way.
Well, everyone's reactionary first off. You know, the first thing is like just to be like, no, because, and then you, I don't know why. No. So I'm sorry. Let's get the couch you want.
Yeah. I think it is trying to evolve to break down that immediate rejection of things.
Yeah.
Where you go, nope. Oh, fuck.
Well, that's the thing in relationships is you're trying to retrain your brain to not have fixed points of view about everything.
Right.
Like, can you actually listen to your spouse when they are trying to present some argument for something? Can you drop the fact that in your head you think you already know everything about every subject and you're actually waiting for them to stop talking so you could just present the proper position?
Of course.
Yeah. And that is that's the tricky part. Can you actually be open for real?
Right.
And that's what I like about the movie is it really is about people who haven't cracked that yet and they do go at each other really hard because they just haven't figured out all of their communication skills.
It's so hard. I mean, I think, you know, I equate getting old with inflexibility, and the less flexible you are, and it starts very simply where it's for, you know, where I feel like for me, a lot of it's the fucking new music now. So, like, I'm already becoming inflexible about art. Like, I think it all starts with art. When you're inflexible about your art, then it just goes down. It just goes downhill from there.
Well, that's the whole reason why I had had Graham Parker and the Rumor in the movie. Because in the movie, Paul Rudd has his own record label, and he only releases music from the 70s and 80s of all of these artists he thinks should still be famous.
Right.
That he looks up to. But he doesn't listen to new music anymore. He doesn't. He's the guy that didn't sign Arcade Fire.
Yeah.
And we all get to that point where we just stop listening to new music. Our heads are full. And I have had a really weird thing lately where suddenly when I hear a lot of classic rock, I get the feeling that I've never heard it before. Like, I'm enjoying it as if I haven't heard Stairway to Heaven 300 times. And it's been happening over the last like 4 or 5 months. A song will come on, some obscure Led Zeppelin song, and I will have a religious experience as if I've never heard it. And I've heard it to the point of like a year ago hating all of that music. But for some reason, my whole brain just refreshed on it.
You're starting to, you're understanding it in a way, or you're seeing something, the message, like, oh my God, just like the like Talking Heads song. Oh, of course. Yeah. That's what he's trying to say.
Jimmy Page is God.
I thought everyone was fucking... I didn't get it before, but now... Yeah. But although there are some things today where I just don't think I'll ever be like, oh my God, you know, I totally get the Jonas Brothers now. Like, I don't think I'll ever have that moment of clarity.
I hope not.
If I did, will you please suck my brain juices out?
Yes, that'll be the time.
And retain your own
youth. That's how you know.
Is there anything else you want to promote or talk about before we let you go?
Well, that's a very good question. Well, mainly This Is 40 come December 21st. I'm excited for people to see that. I think they'll like it. And Girls starts in January.
Excellent.
That's a great show.
On HBO. And that's really that's all that's happening. You know, it's hard to get people to go to the movies this day. I mean, because, you know, we're competing against, you know, The Hobbit and Django Unchained. And, you know, there has to be like a place in the movies for, you know, human hard comedies.
Yeah. is there any Anchorman 2 business going on?
Anchorman 2 is going to start shooting in March.
Fucking
Adam
sweet.
McKay and Will Ferrell just wrote the draft. And Adam McKay is going to direct, as always. And it's so funny. They really just kick the shit out of it. I you know, the bar is so high. And you know, when we did the first one, we reshot the entire A story, like the main story.
Oh, fuck.
We reshot all the stuff with the bear. There was a whole other story that was so crazy. And it really made us laugh. And we put it out. There's a DVD that has the Ron Burgundy, The Legend Continues. And we made a whole other movie out of all of the story that we removed from the first one. So it's really tricky to make something that's so, you know, silly and absurd. Like, how much should it track?
Yeah.
You know, what is the line for this? So in starting again, it was funny to have those talks with them. Like, what are the rules for Anchorman? Yeah. They watched it again and they were like, this movie's really sloppy, the first one. how do you do another one like this?
You can't fake that. You can't fake that.
It has to work emotionally and it has to capture a certain spirit and it still has to have a certain energy. But they wrote something that is...
That's good.
So weird and so funny.
It's even more of a challenge because when Anchorman first came out, there hadn't been an Anchorman yet. So you get to surprise people with these characters. Yeah. And so how do you, you know, when people are coming in with like, this is going to be the single greatest cinematic comedy experience I've ever had. Like, how do you fucking...
You can't think about it. You just have to see if you can make yourself giggle alone in a room.
Is that the test? Is that how you know you're hitting the right spot? Sometimes I feel like if I laugh too hard at something that I write, it's never going to work because it's too inside for me.
I think it's all about, at some point, as soon as you decide you're going to make anything, you just have to think, I'm going to shut the world out and see if this amuses me, and we'll see if it's as good as it needs to be. We'll find out in 6 or 7 months. But the idea of worrying about it only hurts your ability to do it. So you just have to say, is it funny if Ron Burgundy's in this situation? And like, man, that seems crazy. That's funny. and that's the only test of it.
You are the godfather of so many. I do a bowling show on the YouTubes, where we have like, you know, we bowled against the cast of Mad Men and the cast of Walking Dead. And you have so many teams that I like. I want an Anchorman team. I want a Freaks and Geeks team. That's a Bridesmaids. Like, you're basically an entire fucking league.
If I could get those people to bowl.
Of bowling teams that I want to
exploit. Are you a serious bowler?
Maybe.
Yes, he is.
Maybe. See, when I was a kid, I my best friend, Ronald Garner, my other best friend, Kevin Weltman, we decided to bowl for money. And like back then, you know, we bowled for like a couple hundred bucks each and like 10th or 11th grade.
Oh, shit.
And then I was the only one who quietly took bowling lessons. No one even thought you could take a bowling lesson. But there was always a guy at our local Syosset, Woodbury Lanes, like always had on the wall, Big Al, bowling lessons with Big Al.
Right.
And he had his, you know, 300 game card framed. Yeah. And I actually went and took a lesson and kicked their asses. Like, oh, you can learn how to do this from a professional.
Someone's got the bowling gene, Judd. Yes. Well, hopefully one of these days I'll be able to convince you to come out and dust off the old bowling
shoes. I'm going to bring the Celtic Pride cast.
Please. We could just do a whole season of just of
all the kids
movies.
From Heavyweights.
We have Heavyweights coming out December 11th on Blu-ray. We spent like 4 months making all these documentaries. We went and interviewed all the kids. Went out of our way. So for those of you waiting for Heavyweights, that's coming out.
We could do Heavyweights. We could do Stiller and Odenkirk and Janine and Andy Dick.
Right. Yeah.
Andy Dick might be in a bowling center right now. He fucking knows? Who knows?
He could be anywhere.
Where he is. Well, it's good to see you, man. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Pleasure to enjoy this incredibly cold room with you.
Yes, that's right. Well, it's like a casino. We try to block out what time it is and the temperature. Right.
Not the warmth of our
personality. You guys were warm.
The first year, it was very warm, and we gave people Snuggies, and we fed them turkey dinners, and then we felt that the energy was just not what we needed it to be. All right, enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Blah.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.